Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. This week's post is going to be one that I know is going to be controversial and is something that we need to talk about still because of some recent things that came up in media. But before I get too far into that subject, I do want to mention that the AAPA Board of Directors 2018 election is happening right now. Well, at least as long as you're listening to this before April 16th, 2018. This is important for us as PAs because this is probably the big election. Now, our different specialties, they have elections, of course, and we want to go into those as well, but this one is going to be doing some things this year that is going to change some aspects of being a PA. So I highly encourage that if you're an AAPA member to go out and vote. Make sure you get this done. I've already voted. I've already made my voice heard, but I want everyone's voices to be heard. So please, 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 if you're listening to this before the deadline, April 16, 2018, make sure you vote. You should have gotten a link. If not, we're going to include a link in the show notes. All right, but without further ado, let's talk about what brings us here today. Now, I labeled this podcast as Indefinite Evidence and Biased Reporting because we've talked about misinformation before. In fact, that was one of our earlier podcasts, and I even made it something that was kind of a for the public piece. But this one is different in my mind. This one is one that I was really worried about because it can easily misrepresent our profession in emergency medicine and can make us easily sound like the bad guys here. Now, as we all know, emergency medicine can have some very controversial issues. And one of those, most classically, is the care of stroke patients, especially regarding TPA. And the reason why I want to bring this up now, because this is something that's been talked about a lot, and I am going to include in the show notes a lot of details because I'm not going to go into as much of the finer points of these arguments because honestly, it's just a lot and I don't want to talk about it all right now. There's no way to talk about it all right now. It's just too lengthy of a process. But what I do want to talk about are some highlights. The reason why this all comes up right now is because on March 26, 2018, the New York Times published two articles by the same person and she wrote these very, very interesting pieces that I would highly encourage you to read so you can understand because a lot of people read the New York Times, so it's very possible that they read her piece and, or I should say pieces in a sense, because she did write two that day. One is the one that really most people are going to read and we're going to talk about more, but this is something that I'm worried about because there are a lot of factors to play in what gets discussed with TPA. Now, if somehow you're listening to this and you're not in emergency medicine, you're incredibly new to emergency medicine, TPA is tissue plasminogen activator. And it's a certain medication that we use. It's called a clot-busting drug, but thrombolysis is very complex, and the pharmacodynamics and kinetics are a little confusing, to say the least. And so really to call it a clot buster is in some ways potentially a misnomer. Now, I'm not a pharmacologist, and I by no means created this drug, but when you go into some of the details about it, there's definitely some controversy with how exactly it works and what time frame it even works in. But my biggest concern reading this article was how it was written. Now, apparently, she is a very, very good writer and investigator. And so some people who have been very familiar with her works were a little surprised with the issues that came up because it's atypical for her. But basically what happened is she got an anonymous tip from a Canadian emergency medicine physician explaining the limitations and potential dangers of TPA. And then she goes on to explain how she had some previous knowledge on the medication and its potential benefits. And when she started to go into this, she believes that there was some concern for quote-unquote fake news and that this was impacting the implementation. So she wanted to write an article basically opposing what this Canadian physician had told her about their concerns and wanted to wait until she could find someone to basically be the victim of her story. And she even basically puts it in that way in her article where she explains why she wrote the main New York Times piece that is so well known right now. And in the process of doing so, she was able to find the researcher, one of the researchers for TPA, and that his father had a stroke and did not receive the medication. And the researcher believes that his father had a bad outcome as a result of not receiving this medication. And obviously, you can twist the other way. Maybe he had a good outcome because he didn't receive it because he didn't suffer the complications of TPA. As one person put it when I was reading through kind of just different opinions of the article, but that's controversy. I don't really want to say that because I don't necessarily agree with the wording of that. Maybe they avoided a potentially bad outcome, but did they have a benefit? That's a lot harder to say considering they did have long-term sequelae from their stroke. But to get back on point with what we are actually talking about, this article that the investigator wrote makes it sound like this is an open and closed case and that there are certain people who are holding out not using TPA or maybe being very, very cautious about their use of TPA because they are behind the times and not really paying attention to the research, which honestly brings up its own mix of information because as anyone in emergency medicine knows and really studies how TPA works, or the evidence behind it, we understand that there's a lot of controversy behind it because there are a lot of studies that have been used with thrombolytics, but especially with TPA. And we have found that TPA has resulted in a lot of negative trials, but there were two very key trials that were positives, and that those two key trials have basically led to our modern stroke care with the use of thrombolysis, particularly, namely, Alteplase or TPA. And that's the one that we know. That's the thing that we hear about is if they're within a certain window, usually less than 3 hours, and then a little more restrictive window at 3 to 4.5 hours, we're going to use this medication if they follow specific criteria and if they opt into this, which becomes its own issue. Now, with the article itself, like I said, they make it sound like this is an open and closed case and that this is it. But they also cite some facts without actual citations that are also concerning. They talk about up to 30% of stroke victims who arrive at hospital on time and are perfect candidates for the clot buster do not receive it. However, there's no citation to go with it. And then they talk about and heavily imply that those who did not receive TPA are destined to permanent disability, which could have been prevented by TPA. Again, that's extremely controversial, and there's much to discuss there. But again, I don't want to get into all this right now. I want to get into some of the other key points. They also talk about how the rates of cerebral hemorrhage have declined as doctors have gained better experience over the years. But again, they lack any citation with this. Maybe that's true, but it'd be really nice if they had included the articles that back up the claims, the up to 30% not receiving, and the improvement of the cerebral hemorrhage rate over the years. Maybe those things are true, but really would have loved the citations to have gone with it. The other thing they talk about is, of course, that there is a risk of bleeding, but they made it like a little blip in the article, barely mentioned. I think it was just in one sentence, and they failed to talk about the actual number needed to treat versus the number needed to harm. And that's known as the NNT and the NNH, respectively. Now, the calculations for the NNH, the number needed to harm, depends basically on the study and the overall picture, what you include versus what you don't include. But it falls somewhere between 1 in 17 and 1 in 20. So about 5 to 6% of patients will be harmed for receiving this medication versus the base rate population. And that's important. We need to know that intracranial hemorrhage and death, the symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, I should say, and death, that's a big deal. These are things that can lead to permanent disability. And obviously, if you die, that's kind of the ultimate negative outcome that we'd be worried about. So this is something that wasn't even really mentioned in the article. And to me, that's a huge thing we need to talk about when we talk about TPA is that some people may, and I stress may, have a benefit with TPA, but there's obviously people who are going to have harm with this. Now, I do want to mention quickly for those who are interested in what the number need to treat is, based on the post hoc analysis of the NINS trial, and I can talk about that more here in a second, for a favorable outcome, it was an NNT of 8. The favorable outcome is kind of wishy-washy, and really there are some better resources that talk about it more because it is something you have to dive into. But just understand that that number need to treat of 8 does not imply mortality. It is more about how maybe they neurologically improved, but there's some questions with that. Also, in the ECAS-3 trial, that's basically the 3 to 4.5 hour window, is an NNT of 15 for a, again, favorable outcome, but no mortality difference there either. We need to remember this because when we're talking about improvement, that in some ways is subjective. And again, we could talk about that more if we need to. But what we really are looking at is that mortality difference. This is scary because this is something that can ultimately kill patients when they would have otherwise had a chance. And we need to just keep that at least in mind. But the big thing, the thing I really want to talk about most today, the part that had me most concerned with this publication was the direct attack on the use of social media to help share knowledge. Specifically, not necessarily directly quoted and said this way, but extremely heavily implied, was that FOMED was basically the evil source of it all. They talk about blogs and podcasts specifically, but when you're talking about blogs and podcasts, this is usually part of the FOMED community, which is free and open access medical education. For those who are listening who don't realize it, you are listening to a FOMED podcast. You are reading on a FOMED blog. And the reason why that matters is because you are getting this information for free versus going to a conference or reading a journal, which are paid sources. And what this article is saying is that these blogs and podcasts are leading to the downfall of medicine because you're going to a source that they say is not being peer-reviewed and not being appropriately in check versus the journals and conferences that you're going to, which are being paid for, and talking to the experts directly is their thought there. A couple of key issues there with that. First off, yes, I am in a sense peer-reviewed. I have many colleagues from locally and abroad all over the world are reading and listening to my blog and podcast. And they let me know when they don't agree with things. I'm sure a couple of them are going to talk to me about what I said with TPA and with stroke care. And that's fine. This is how we stay in check. When we have comments, when we talk on Twitter or Facebook or directly or emails, whatever the case may be, we're staying in check that way. A lot of your really big blogs and podcasts like MCRET, SGEM, Corium, Rebelium, any of those types of things, any one of the key FOMED places, because some of the smaller ones, they may never be really any more than a blip on the radar. Maybe a couple people find it, and maybe you can point out that those are not really getting the peer review process. Okay, but when you get people who are getting hundreds, thousands, maybe even millions of views and reads, yeah, they're getting proper peer review in a sense by their actual peers directly. But I'm waiting for you guys to say, but Chip, what about journals? Journals are peer reviewed. Yes, but as evidence is growing in this, journals are flawed because you do have a peer review process. But as they've shown before, there are certain journals out there, just like there may be certain blogs and podcasts that are absolute crap and are simply out there to make money and or do not have the evidence base and the backing that's appropriate. These so-called experts aren't experts, or it's just simply a money mill project to get yourself published or to get information out there so they can get money for it. This is, again, a big problem because journals are not always the best in the peer review process. And the peer review process itself is limited to a couple of things. Furthermore, the other thing we have to keep in mind is that with the conferences, we run into some of the same issues. And we have one person who gives a lot of information versus having multiple sources in a quick and easy manner that we get through the blogs and podcasts. So I like it because with blogs and podcasts, I can go to a lot of different places and get information that has been at least partially digested, if not put in an easy way for me to understand so that when I do go and read an article, that it will make a lot more sense than if I just read the journal article without anyone trying to help explain it to me. And I can compare too. If I read an article that I disagree with the summary, I can then talk to the person and see why we have differing opinions, or maybe it can just at least help me get me on the right path. But I think the biggest thing you're going to find from almost anyone in FOMED is that we are all on the same page, that you can't just rely on blogs and podcasts alone. You need to have the bigger picture. You need to go to different sources. You need to go through different methods to help get your medical knowledge. I don't think anyone is trying to say otherwise. If they are, I wouldn't agree with them anyway. So a couple of other quick things here. Just because we are talking about TPA, keep in mind the guidelines have been changing with time with stroke care, especially the American College of Emergency Physicians. In 2015, they updated their guidelines in ways that are extremely important because, unlike so many guidelines that are out there, they made it very clear, quote, there were no relevant industry relationships disclosed by the subcommittee members. Why this matters for us is because in a lot of these other places and guidelines and such as the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association, is that there is some bias there. They're being paid or they're receiving money to help with these guidelines from these companies that are basically needing to be backed in one way or the other by you using thrombolytics, particularly TPA. And this becomes very, very complex when we look at the people who are quoted, even in the article that we talk about in this particular podcast. These people are also receiving finances in one way or another. This is all very important because what is their bias then? Now, bias is something that's always tricky because people usually are not meaning to be biased in their opinion. Everyone's got their own bias in a sense, but it's very important that we understand, we try and keep as open a mind as possible. I am one person in particular. I believe that there are a lot of limitations to TPA, but there may still be a benefit to it. We just maybe are still trying to find the right population, just like with neurointerventional care. So I'm going to make a very balanced conversation with my patients talking about the risks and benefits. And I'm going to follow the ACIP guidelines, which talk about that you should or may, depending on the time frame, offer this medication and consider it with carefully selected patients. And the reason why this matters is because we need to be able to think critically with our care, not just follow guidelines that says we have to do this. Like it used to say in the guidelines, basically was that we should be always giving this when we really didn't have the evidence to back it up. We need to make sure that our patients and family understand that there are some real risks with this medication. I'd also like to mention that they made it sound like the NINS trial is such a solid trial. Well, out of the 13 most commonly frequently cited articles regarding TPA, thrombolytics, and stroke, those 13 articles, 5 of them had to be stopped early due to increased mortality, and you'll see this in the show notes, and then only 2 had positive trials, and the rest demonstrated no benefit. Now, the most famous one, the one that kind of kicked everything off, was the NINS 2 trial in 1995, and this is what is really at the heart of the discussion, but it also had some major flaws that we had to think about. One of the biggest ones, probably one of the ones that are least known by people when they quote this, is that the original primary outcome was for improvement in functional and stroke scores by 20%, but it was never reported and it was changed post hoc, so after the actual trial was over, to a favorable versus unfavorable dichotomous outcome, which led to that calculated NNT of 8. But they never even go back to the original numbers and report, did that happen, the original primary outcome? And I think that's huge because if they don't even mention it all, is it really the right thing? Furthermore, another common issue and one that's not well known is what's called a fragility index. And this is basically how good of a study, how solid of a study, and how well it could be reproduced. Now, we talk about the numbers in the show notes too, but all you need to do is have 3 patients with a different outcome. So a fragility index of 3 for this study basically means that it could have led to a different outcome. With that number of patients and with the loss to follow-up that they had, it's very possible that you could have had 3 patients swing the other direction and make this basically a negative trial. And again, this is a very complex matter, and we've included in the show notes a really good post by Palmcrit that helps explain this a lot more and basically shows that maybe the NINS trial isn't as strong as we thought it was. briefly, just to mention the ECAS 3 trial of 2008. This was the only other favorable trial. Again, the NNT was 15 without any difference in mortality. And both these scores were based on a modified Rankin scale, which also includes its own flaws, such as that of inter-observer variability, which again matters because maybe someone would have had a score that would have been considered favorable versus not favorable when one person looks at, but not the other person. So inter-observer variability is very important to consider. So all in all, what I'm worried about here is this article is fraught with bias. Whether they meant to or not, there are definitely some issues here. I really, really would like to believe that they did not mean to have the bias, but it was very clear. And that was my concern. They were biased about the actual research and implying that it was well established when really there's a lot of indefinite evidence. Maybe there is some good with TPA, and I hold hope that TPA we're going to find better uses for with stroke care specifically. We already use thrombolytics in pulmonary embolism and myocardial infarctions and those types of things with some decent evidence with it. It's building in certain ways. Maybe the pulmonary embolism research right now is not as strong. The MI research seems to be pretty solid in of itself and has a lot larger population base than the stroke studies have ever contained. But stroke is still very iffy, and it's something we really, really have to consider. And again, the bias that they have against the current methods of social media and FOMED is really concerning because basically we're setting ourselves up for failure and attacking an entire method of learning that has forever changed medicine is only going to cause more damage. The way I think about it, it's akin to staying mute and only reading textbooks because talking to other people with different experiences and knowledge would be sacrilege in the house of medicine. That is really what we're getting towards when we attack social media and FOMED and everything else. These are legitimate ways to help. Obviously, we have to be very cautious with it, and there are so many different blogs and podcasts that talk about that specifically. But the internet and social media, along with just FOMED as a whole, has led to the cut down of knowledge translation and has led to us be able to take more evidence to the bedside more quickly. Like I said, I would love to talk about TPA and stroke more, but I'm already going over kind of my usual time. So I am going to include a bunch of this in the show notes. If you want to specifically have this conversation where we can talk about it and basically go over what a lot of other people have gone, I'm more than happy to do so, but I just don't want to repeat and regurgitate what a lot of other people have said. But if you want to, that's perfectly fine. We'll be happy to put that in blog and podcast form. Just let me know. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.